listeners, it's Jinners from the Mixtape Memories podcast here to tell you about something positive. Sex positive, in fact. If you're like me, by now you've probably got a lot of time on your hands and are desperately seeking some form of pleasure or a stimulus. Well, I've got this awesome offer for you from our lovely sponsor, AdamandEve.com. Right now, you can select almost any one item for 50% off at AdamandEve.com. But wait, on top of all that, you will also get some awesome free stuff to spice up your bedroom. Enter the code MIXTAPE, that's M-I-X-T-A-P-E, MIXTAPE at checkout and get 10 free gifts. Few special sexy items, plus 6 spicy movies, and you got a whole evening ahead of you. And also, free shipping, can't forget that. Get yourself a gift, or surprise your partner or partners, as it may be, with a gift. And don't forget to put together a special mixtape playlist to set the right mood. Shoegaze, perhaps? The offer code again is MIXTAPE, M-I-X. T-A-P-E, mixtape, at AdamandEve.com.
Hello and welcome to Mixtape Memories. I'm Matt Hartspade.
And I'm Jinners. We're here today with a very special guest. She's the co-creator of The Daily Show, a renowned comedian, writer, and producer, as well as an amazing reproductive rights advocate and social justice warrior with Abortion Access Front. Welcome, Liz Winstead.
Hey!
Thank you so much for joining us.
So happy to have you. We're all here in New York City, but we're recording this remotely because of COVID-19 and coronavirus pandemic and the lockdown. Liz, how are you doing during this time?
You know, I think I'm doing sort of like everyone. I think we've all gone through various phases of how we're dealing and what was funny, interesting, sad, outrageous, and now everything, and now what's poignant, what's not. You know, I am somebody who is of a certain age, which is why you're having me on your podcast to talk about the mixtapes, but also, you know, as we're looking at COVID ravaging people's lives, not to start on a downer, but it's very reminiscent of when they were publishing people who were dying of HIV/AIDS in the 80s. Mm-hmm. And you were seeing old acquaintances and loved ones who you hadn't spoken to for a while who had been taken by AIDS. And now it's sort of back in the papers and they're publishing the names of people. And now we have social media. So you're seeing friends and loved ones and friends adjacent. So it's it's just a wild ride, man. And the city of New York, I don't know what it's going to be when we're done, you know? So I think nostalgia and looking through things like this are important for us to remind ourselves that we've gotten through a lot of stuff and we've had joy and we're going to have joy again. And let's celebrate the things that bring us joy. And I love this podcast.
Thank you. No, it feels kind of, obviously everything is uncertain right now and there's a sense of anxiety and I don't know, it's just wild. In my neighborhood, I'm near Prospect Park, and I'm not too far away from Kings County Hospital. And the sirens are literally every 4 or 5 minutes. In fact, I'd be shocked if we didn't have at least one in the background of this recording. It's wild.
Yeah, I feel you. I am I'm the same way in near a main thoroughfare, and the sirens are relentless.
Yeah. Liz, have you been listening to any music to kind of calm the mood a bit last couple of weeks?
I have. I listened to a lot of stuff. In fact, ironically, I have. I started cleaning my apartment and I found this massive box of old mixtapes mixtapes and just cassette tapes. And so I go on Facebook at 3 o'clock and I didn't go through them. I just saw them and I'm just doing a hand grab and then talking about the memories associated with the mixtapes that I have for like 30 minutes on Facebook. So it's a really fun companion to be able to do this and go back. And I found like amazing stuff that I forgot I had. Like I have like the demo tapes from Soul Asylum's Horse They Rode In On. And I have Elvis Costello Live from the Bottom Line in 1977, you know, and go, and I have this like Husker Du, this Husker Du, I have never opened it. It was a extra that you got at their last, on their last tour. Compilation of live, songs that they did live. So, yeah, all this really fun stuff. And I can't remember, what else was in there. And I promised myself I wouldn't look so that it's fresh to me too. And I do it on Facebook. So been really great. So I've mostly been listening to like old funk, and dance music from like the 70s and 80s, just so I can get off my ass, my apartment. And I have been a devotee of also D Nice's dance parties. I think they've been really helpful and fun. So I've been heading over there on Instagram. There's one tonight. I'll be dancing around tonight in my apartment, maybe with Michelle Obama. I don't know. But I have been, it's interesting. I haven't been trying to discover any kind of new music, which is interesting. I've been really leaning into music that I can really identify as times of great social significance for me, and that brought back a lot of interpersonal memories, so I can hang on to those. So that's kind of where I've been for sure.
What's been like an artist that you've kind of went back and are nostalgic with right now that's brought you comfort?
Well, we'll talk about one of them today, for sure. But I was lucky enough to grow up in the Twin Cities in the 80s and 90s in the heyday of what was happening in music, alternatively in funk and everything. And so I've really been listening to a lot of Replacements, a lot of Husker Du, a lot of the funk scene, Prince, The Time, and then the like deep cuts of like Alexander O'Neill and Des Dickerson. And, you know, there's some old, you know, other stuff, funk that was around back in the day that was sort of very regional. So I've been really leaning into my old punk rock roots and especially localized Twin Cities bands.
Nice. Yeah, I was wondering if Replacements were going to come up.
It's funny because I was like, I feel like that would have been so obvious for me to pick some one of the last, you know, recordings from them back in the day. And then I was like, I think I'm gonna go with something from the beginning of the decade and something from the end of the decade in the 90s. And so that's kind of where we went. And I picked something I really love from the end of the decade I don't think a lot of people would probably pick. So
do you remember like the first band that you fell in love with?
You know, it's funny because I am the youngest of five kids in my family. And my oldest sisters are many parents' age. You know, my oldest sister's 72. And so I was not allowed to touch their records or their record player. So I would sit outside of their bedroom when they have their friends over. And like, so the first person that I loved was David Bowie, because my sisters had great taste in music. And so, I mean, when I was, you know, 9 years old or 10, like I knew the words to every song on Hunky Dory. You know, I would sing along in crazy like Lou Reed, and they really loved glam and really good rock music. So I think David Bowie was the first person that I loved. And that I was like so passionate about, because it got played a lot in my house. And then subsequently, I could tell what was going on in my sister's lives, because of course they wouldn't ever talk to me, by the music they would play. So it would be like, there would be David Bowie going, and then it would just be bitchy ass sisters and Joni Mitchell playing. So I was like, oh, something happened. Some boy did something to somebody, right? And so I think I adopted a lot of my emotional music based on the influences of my siblings, I feel really lucky about that. So, you know, to be able to have Lou Reed and, you know, just then old Janis Joplin and really good stuff in the house. I feel like it put me on a path of really exploring music that wasn't just handed to me or presented to me on the radio, which is really great.
Oh, that is great. Yeah, it's funny you mentioned Bowie because lately I've been listening to the Let's Dance album a lot. And I think for me, tying it back to what we were talking about earlier, it's been sort of this point of a relief from it all, just dancing through it. I feel like I'd rather listen to stuff that gets me excited and want to move and bring some sort of positive nostalgic energy than to kind of wallow in the seriousness of everything going on.
You know, I feel the exact same way. And I feel Jen and I have had many conversations around this, but I am 58 and I am in the sweet spot of age where I have so many incredible memories of seeing so many great bands in small spaces, mm-hmm. in very intimate venues of just, you know, the coming of age of punk rock music and everything. And, you know, when I think about growing up in Minneapolis and First Avenue, the shows, everything from I saw Tina Turner there and the Waterboys and the Replacements a bazillion times and Prince a bazillion times, you know. And so to be able to have all of those, to be able to have those conversations with friends around the experiences of all of those shows and what music really meant. And then as a performer to be able to have stood on that stage, it's really, really good to go back and think about being able to see, you know, like Billy Idol and how he had just like really terrible hair. And that his costumes were like kind of like crappy. Like it looks really cool in pictures, but like close up, it was like, are those hair plugs? Like what's going on? So to be able to have that like proximity privilege was really incredible. So there's a lot of stories to tell and they've brought a lot of joy to a lot of my friends who I've been friends with for a really long time.
Yeah, First Avenue, they just celebrated an anniversary, right? Like,
yeah, the 50th anniversary was Friday, April 3rd. And you can still watch it. And they did a taped sort of retrospective. And people did live performances, and it was hosted by Harmar Superstar, who I love. And a lot of old folks came back from and performed and from their living rooms, and people told stories, and it was really great. And it was a benefit for all the, you know, one of the musician funds in the Twin Cities for folks who are just struggling right now because of COVID and who've lost work. So, yeah, it's good. Totally check it out.
It's so great to see like people just come together like that and like really help the community that's suffering right now with like live touring and venues and musicians and artists and any kind of live performer really. And
it's true. You know, people forget that like, and the thing that I think about a lot is, you know, when we come out on the other side of this, what is going to be the new psyche and norm for people wanting to go to shows? Are people going to be super freaked out about being around other people? You know, not only are we just going to get back to normal and people are going to be like, we got through this and we're going to go back and we're going to support these venues and I'm fine being around people again. Maybe I'll just wear a mask to concerts now. I don't know. You know, how does that muffle laughter for comedians? Is that going to change the dynamic and the way that we do things? There's so many, psychological ramifications on top of all of the just practical things that we think about, that those are the kind of things that I'm really thinking about more as a performer. Like, what does this all mean?
Yeah, I agree. I think it's going to be a little bit of both. I think there's going to be a lot of people that are incredibly excited to experience something in a live fashion. And I think there's also going to be a percentage of people that are not going to want to go out for quite a few months more, even once this has kind of dwindled, you know, out of our system. I don't know.
I know. It's going to be really, it's going to be really interesting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, just like watching the live streams happen, there's both mixed feelings about that, I feel like. Like sometimes it seems to work. You know, these DJ parties that I've been going to have been super fun. But I feel like the comedy stuff that I've seen has been kind of mixed. Like sometimes I feel like it works, sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah, I feel like that's right too. I feel like for comics, or how I've approached it is to be funny in a different way, or, you know, to sort of bring your personality out and be not try to tell jokes and do stand up, but more like my, when I do my mixtape show, or just like relating about something that's silly or whatever. I think that I'm don't think I would do well doing stand up just trying to do a show in my living room. I don't even know.
Yeah, I mean, I can't even imagine just not having the you know, the reaction from a live audience. It's just wildly different.
Yeah. So I think ranting and having fun and being a goofball, I don't know if it was saved, but I did watch on Instagram a really fun conversation with Mike Birbiglia and Maria Bamford. Mm-hmm. He's doing these Instagram conversations and he's bringing people on and talking. And she just was in this character and he was just talking to her. And you know how she does those characters and she's so dead on. And she was just this character who was just very, very neat. It felt like she had so much to offer about her validation and feelings around Corona and what she was going through and why she needed the things that she was needing. And it's so funny. Go search for it. And if you find it, watch it, because it's really funny. It's good.
Oh, I will. That does sound funny.
Yeah.
I wanted to bring the conversation back to the mixtapes. And if you could share a little bit more about what kind of stuff you put on it, or what kind of stuff other folks put on the mixtapes for you. Did you find it more that you were the receiver of the mixtapes or creating them? How did it kind of work back in the day?
You know, the mixtapes that I still have are, I would say, I don't have any that I made myself so far in my grab bag, right? I've grabbed two that were made by a guy who wanted to go out with me and a guy who was going out with me.
Okay.
So two I have found so far were romance-y based and really interesting. Everything, the guy that wanted to go out with me, actually, they were both great mixtapes. The guy who wanted to go out with me, he was more wooing me on, look at this wide range of music that I like. So it was everything from Nick Cave to Hank Williams Sr. to the Waterboys to the Buzzcocks to Gun Club. But he didn't have any women on the mixtape. Didn't occur to me until I was talking about it. I was like, I love this mixtape. I love this mixtape. This is great. This is great. And then I was like, there's not a woman on here. And then the guy that was dating me, he mixed it up a little bit more and it was more romantic. Like he had things like some like Aretha, That's What I'm Gonna Do. And then he had some, I'm trying to think what else. Oh, God Only Knows by the Beach Boys. And good love songy stuff. Some X, which I really loved. Xene Zervenka's voice. So he had some good mix and he had some women in there, which I was like, oh, that's why I was dating you and not the other one. Good. I feel like he was trying to prove to me that we have stuff in common and put out a great mixtape. Versus a tape of somebody who really likes you and is going out with you and wants you to have these feelings. And it was also a long distance relationship mixtape. So it had a lot of you know, sort of songs about longing and that kind of thing. And yeah, it was good. It was fun. One was handwritten and then one was on like an old timey computer. Like, you know, just like really hilarious to see something that was on a computer and printed out back in the 90s.
Do you remember any mixtapes that maybe you made for somebody that you had a crush on?
You know, I do. And my guess is that they were loaded with Prince and Billy Bragg and Roseanne Cash. and Emmylou Harris, and I really love Bette Davis. I don't know if you know Bette Davis, but Miles Davis's wife put out two incredible funk records. And if you are a fan of Macy Gray, or I would say, yeah, you'll really like Bette Davis, but really great, gritty stuff. I'm sure that was on there. And so, but I don't remember. I remember I have a lot of the two mixtapes that I have were tapes that I used to go running. Mm-hmm. And when I would run, I was a runner for like a year. And they both ended with Billy Bragg's Great Leap Forward into Hole of the Moon by the Waterboys. So there's like both songs have a build and then like a run and then a slow build and then a run. That was my jam. And I know I had more mixtapes for running. And they all ended with those two songs. So yeah. But like making mixtapes was really hard.
Well, there was like the chemistry of it all and the order and what the sentiment was. I mean, there's a lot that goes into it.
Really a lot. And you're really thinking about it. And you're really also, I think everybody is self-conscious. Like, is this going to be trite? Is this going to be cool? Are they going to be like completely weirded out? I made this. Like, it's an effort. Like, I did this thing. And you make mixtapes a lot of times with intention and hoping that intention is going to be received in a good way, right? Mm-hmm. So I love that the anticipation and the innocence of everything around it is very cool. And I don't know what the equivalent of it now is. It's like, you know, I don't know how it really did play a role in courtship and relationship building. And I don't know if there's anything that has taken over for it.
I don't either. I mean,
what's your Spotify list? Like, that's not interesting.
It's not sexy. No.
Not at all. And also going through, it's very tactile. Also, you know, you would go through, you know, your records and you would put a song on and you would record the song from the record. And, you know, and so it was a lot of that as well, you know, just handling things and all of it. So.
Yeah. Designing it, yeah. Like, oh, I used to draw on.
That's right. What about artwork?
You know, I don't know if anybody ever like responded to any of my romantic mixtapes, though. I don't
really think they were
very successful.
Well, what did you put on them, Jen? Do you remember?
Yeah. Once I had a crush on a professor in college, and I made him a mixtape.
Oh God.
But it was all like things that I thought maybe he would like. He was older, so.
Oh my God.
It might have been like, like Ella Fitzgerald and Billy.
Oh my God. He was probably like, oh my God, she thinks I'm a fucking ancient monster. Picture of Walker on the outside of the mixtape. It's called Insure. So I can insure you in for my life.
It's really funny now that I think about it.
Also, professors just wanted you to fuck them. You could have just saved the time.
Exactly.
It's true. I think it came out later that he was sleeping with his students. Just not me. But Oh my god. Well, how else back then did you like discover music?
I think, you know, the good news is independent record stores were incredibly important, and we had very strong independent record stores. And like I said, I have this unique experience of being in Minneapolis. And so Twin Tone Records, which is the, you know, record label that made all the Replacements records and the early Soul Asylum records and, you know, Husker Du records were housed in, it was a studio and a record company, and it was across the street from the coolest independent record store. So there was a scene happening constantly. So definitely that. The weird thing was Minnesota didn't have a great independent radio station for a long, long time.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, until the mid-90s, I think, or towards the end of the 90s, they did not have one. And now they have a great one called The Current, which you can stream. And I highly suggest, if you are looking for good radio, The Current is where it is incredible.
Yeah, I've booked a couple sessions with my day job. I'm a music publicist, arts publicist, and I've booked some sessions on NPR, and it's great. It's great.
Yeah. Oh, but what was cool, I think the coolest part of how I discovered music was because there was such a strong music scene and strong comedy scene in the Twin Cities, we were all working together at the same restaurants doing it for our day jobs. And so we would fill in for each other's shifts, and the musicians would come and see the comics, and the comics would go see the musicians, and we were always on everybody's guest list. And so just through community, people would introduce us to music, and then we would introduce each other to music and bands, and then a lot of the bands would go out on the road and come back and say, oh, we worked with these guys and they were great. And sure enough, but mostly for me, it was going into record stores a couple times a week and just asking folks what came in, what they like. And if you talk to people enough at a record store, they really get to know your taste and they'll recommend stuff. And that was really fun. And in-stores, ugh, in-stores were the best.
Oh, I miss in-store performances.
So much.
Were there in-stores at Electric Fetus?
Oh, yeah. The Fetus had in-stores. Garage Door had in-stores. And this record store called Orfolk Jokopus, which was a great indie store as well. And so, yeah, all of the record stores that were indies in the Twin Cities would do in-stores, which is really great.
Yeah, I have memories of going to in-stores at Virgin Megastore Union Square back in the day, even some at Times Square. But yeah, I haven't been to an in-store in quite some time. I mean, there are so few places to go to an in-store because there are so few independent record shops left in New York.
Tower used to do them too, that Tower record store.
Oh yeah, I saw Scissor Sisters there back in the day.
Yeah, I used to live on the block from there. And then the No Name Records across the street was great.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I think Other Music used to do
that. Other Music, that's right. Yeah, Other Music.
Yeah, and like back in the day in Williamsburg when Soundfix Records used to be there, they used to have in stores as well. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I feel like you don't really hear about that much. And I like the Amoeba Records, like they're going, you know, into extinction, I feel like, right? They're like closing down and stuff. So I feel like the whole independent or record store is just sadly kind of dissipating.
It's really sad because to be able to have access to people who passionately love music and want to talk to anybody about it and find out what you like and passionately talk to you about that is an art form that will be sadly missed. And, mm-hmm. you know, it just makes me feel like, especially for people who are not social creatures and have a hard time, and oftentimes music is a real solace, to find those communities of people who can talk about music because it's where so much communication and emotion happens, to remove those access points is really sad.
Yeah, yeah. I agree.
I mean, Matt, do you see like any kind of equivalent today when you're like booking kind of musicians and places?
I mean, not really. I mean, we've spoken about this at various other points of the, you know, over the last season and a half. And I just feel like so much of new music that's coming out now is almost built to be disposable, you know, that there isn't, you don't have that same connection that you would have. I don't know. It's disappointing. It's for me, it's kind of a sad state right now. And I don't know what the equivalent is to answer your question.
Yeah, I think that's, and I feel like that's true. And I feel like where's the space to be a touring musician and have this sort of solid, interesting life that you can live and make records and sell out, you know, 400 or 500 seat venues. And in big cities, you can perform at a, you know, 1,000 seat space. You know, I feel bad that without record stores and without being able to nurture those kind of careers, it's a bummer, you know, that you can't have specialty acts that you love that will exist, because everybody's got to make everybody money. Mm-hmm. And that means really trying to be accessible to everyone, which is impossible.
Exactly. Yeah. But yeah, I remember just back in the day picking up a magazine, whether it was, you know, a British publication like Q or NME, or whether it was looking through all the Billboard charts when I was a teenager. I don't know, but there was this excitement, and then I'd want to seek out, you know, and find out, well, who is Pulp exactly? And, mm-hmm. you know, I'm going to buy their album, and I'm going to spend time learning about them and the, you know, Jarvis Cocker's whole shtick and whatnot. I feel like there isn't that like learning curve with a band, or the patience with a band. Now it's just kind of, everything is so immediate and then kind of disappears quickly. I don't know. That's my view.
Yeah. And I remember, you know, looking when they would sell the Village Voice at the newsstand downtown in Minnesota, and I would, you know, you'd go pick it up and you'd just look at the ads in the back of the clubs, and like every cool person, you know, was performing all at once. And I remember just like feeling overwhelmed about like wanting to move to New York so desperately, and being like, how will I ever exist if I ever live there? Because I will just have to see every show.
Yeah. That was how we were.
Exactly. Yeah.
We were out every night at a show.
Oh yeah.
I remember like planning, you know, planning it out way in advance. Like be like, oh, this person's coming in 2 months. I have to go buy that ticket. And, you know, like, I don't really do that anymore.
I know, you get older. I know. I feel lucky too, having lived in a place like Minneapolis where a lot of people came through as well. Mm-hmm. And then working at First Avenue on top of it, it was like, I got to see so many shows for free in lieu of my academics.
Yeah. I would love to hear like your favorite memory from First Avenue.
My favorite memories from First Avenue are hands down the Secret Prince shows. Mm. And he did 12 of them. I think I was at 11 of them. I might have been at all 12, but I don't know for sure. And the biggest memory that stands out is I've seen a million different incredible shows there. You know, U2's first tour, REM's first tour, like every band, you know, out. Oasis, all of it. But the coolest show ever was Prince did a benefit for the ballet company in the Twin Cities. And it was, I got on the guest list and somebody sent me a picture of the guest list, which is really great. Mm. And it was during the time he was doing the 1999 tour. And he got on stage and played 5 new songs that nobody ever heard, and they were 5 songs from Purple Rain. Mm. He opened up the show with Purple Rain.
Wow.
And, yeah, and there's video. Somebody filmed the show, and I've seen clips of this video, and it's so otherworldly to watch people watching Prince, A, with no cell phones. That's bizarre. But B, with no recognition of the song Purple Rain. So you have an audience full of people just staring. And, you know, Purple Rain has that like 4.5 minute open of just instrumental open. And people just staring like, what is this? Like, what's happening?
Yeah, and that sounds a little surreal.
It was surreal. It was surreal. And my favorite moment of the night is that he covered Joni Mitchell's A Case of You, which is one of my favorite songs. And then he did it acoustic guitar, and it was incredible. So that is my most cherished memory of seeing something at First Avenue. But, you know, there's been so many shows there that I've seen every single person almost in rock that I've ever wanted to see. And that's a pretty big statement. You know, I saw that. I mean, it's wild, but and a lot of them at that venue. At First Avenue. So, you know, when I think about it, I sort of gobsmacked at how many people we've lost. You know, to see The Replacements with Bob Stinson and to see Vic Chestnut and to see, you know, so many people, the Husker Du, you know, which who have members that are gone now. And it's really sad. Prince, for God's sakes, you know.
Yeah.
I'm wondering how those Prince shows all differed from each other. I mean, you don't have to go into all the details of all of them, but I mean, he would pretty much do, for example, one set that was perhaps more rock oriented and then sort of a funky one and then maybe a piano one. Is that correct?
Well, he would. And what would happen was, I was lucky enough to know because I worked there. So there would be variations on what was going to happen, but how it normally went down is there was a grapevine where people knew. And then the doors would close at about 11. They wouldn't let anybody else into the club because they knew. And then Prince would either have full band or just do an acoustic set or try out some stuff. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it would go way past bar close. And sometimes it would be an hour. And so it really varied. Mm-hmm. But he would just decide what he wanted to do. And nobody really knew what was going to happen other than he was going to happen. So
that's enough.
That's enough. It is totally enough. Yeah. So, and then there was all these weird after parties before he built Paisley Park. He had this weird warehouse that he rented, and he would have these parties like where he would just have beds everywhere and people just laying around drinking, and like there was tigers walking around one of them, and I mean it was wild.
Well, I mean, it's Prince. You have to expect the extravagance and flamboyance of it all.
And he would never attend in the sense of participating. He was always observing or performing, but there was never like talking to Prince or hanging out with Prince. I think that when people start getting into the whole, I really knew Prince, it's like, did ya? Because I don't feel like I feel like his personal life was so close to the vest that he really wanted to bring joy, and it was so weird because you would go to First Avenue and go dancing on the, I think they had at the time Mondays and Thursdays were, I think it was Mondays and Thursdays were the night that there would be a concert in the main room. And then, it would be a dance party, the rest of the time. And he would come down and stand in the DJ booth and just watch people dance.
Wow.
A couple nights a week.
That's intimidating.
Yeah. It was wild. I mean, he was in the club four nights a week, is my guess. Just like walking around and being at the club with his bodyguard who looked like Santa. this guy named Chick. Yeah.
Well, I feel like that's a good way for us to segue into our first repeat skip, which is Prince and the New Power Generation's 1991 album Diamonds and Pearls.
Yes.
So, what's your memory of this release, Liz?
So what's interesting about this release is that I chose, we were talking about it and it came out in the 90s and I wanted to do a selection from the early 90s and then from the later 90s. This is not one of my favorite Prince records. I think Diamonds and Pearls is a gorgeous song. But I do like the introduction of Michael Bland on the drums. Michael Bland's an incredible drummer. And so I feel like this record is sort of retro in a way. And some of it with a fail and some of it great. The videos from this record are god awful. I am talking about so terrible, like shocking actually. I think it was a record that came out like right, it was the first time since the Revolution that he actually credited his band. It was a whole new band. It came out right after that shitty Cherry Moon movie. And so, and that was a bomb. Like, that was embarrassing for Prince. So this record was a big deal for him to do something with. And I think, you know, Diamonds and Pearl, I think the song had a couple big hits on it.
I looked on Wikipedia and I think like 6 or 7 singles were released from this album, even though yeah. I don't think they all were huge hits.
No, I think Diamonds and Pearls was a big hit.
Yeah.
And then Push was a big, kind of a big song. And then the worst song that of Prince is on this record.
Well, I think with this album, I feel like he was for me anyway, it seems like he was going in the early stages of experimenting with various things outside of the pop bubble.
Yeah.
And it worked with mixed success.
Yeah. I think he was trying, you know, I mean, as we watched the rise of hip hop happening right then, I think he was trying to integrate that. I think he was going back to some old roots of his sort of influences of Sly and his influences of Carlos Santana. And I think you can hear some of that. And I think introducing this new band too, and a new set of singers. I think the thing that was just super weird about Prince is that like every woman looks exactly the same all the time in every video. Like he has a type.
Yes.
And it's so alarming after because they also vaguely look like him.
Yes.
Right.
So but I think that Diamonds and Pearls is a perfect song. So on a record that I feel like is wildly inconsistent and has some ups and downs, I think that song is a perfect song. And so like Push is also I just love. And so those two are the songs that I would listen to over and over again. But I do think that Diamonds and Pearls is just the song that I would go back to constantly from this record.
Jen, what do you feel?
My repeat was it was between two songs actually. It was like I do actually like Cream, but I think it's really funny because I was like reading about it while I was listening to it today, and apparently he said he wrote that song while masturbating.
Yeah. Well, and that video in particular is so cheesy 90s, and they're literally putting whipped cream on their fingers and putting it in each other's mouths, and it's like and then there was some article that was like, this song is not about sex, and I'm like, oh really? What song is about cream? You think this is a song actually about cream?
I just like the silkiness of the music, you know, versus maybe the actual content of it. But also actually I was actually into Money Don't Matter Tonight. So I actually think like
that's a good actually, political song.
Yeah, like really listening to it like song. Today, like it had like such a strong, like I don't know, resonance for me. Like it was just like really speaking to me. So,
well, it's funny, Jen, because I bet you thought I was going to pick that song as my repeat. But, you know, here's the truth. That song, the messaging in that song is incredible, but I don't love the song. The way mm-hmm. I love Sign of the Times mm-hmm. As a political song or a controversy as a political song, I just didn't, that song didn't grab me in a way that it should have considering the messaging in it.
Yeah, it's true. Like the music is pretty lax, but I actually didn't mind that though. I was just rolling with it.
This record doesn't have a get off your ass and just you're going to run to the dance floor moment on it. Mm-mm. For me.
No, it was kind of all over the place.
Yes, 100%. And not to like, you know, and it's funny because I don't think, I'm glad that this was the record we're talking about because it's very rare that you have a conversation around what are the Prince songs that didn't hit for you. Because you can have such a wild mixtape of Prince songs that are all genius, and Prince is my, without a doubt, without a question, like desert island artist. Mm-hmm. I'd just be fine if that's all I could listen to is Prince. This album is is so, like you said, all over the place.
What was your skip on this album?
Oh, Jughead. I mean, stop it. And the thing about it, it's a bummer, is that it starts out again with Michael Bland on the drums being amazing. It, like, if you feel like, oh, are you gonna go into some like cool, like serious, like Johnson Brothers kind of like cool thing, 70s funk, and that just goes into like stupid lyrics and shit I don't care about.
Yeah.
Yeah, that wasn't one of my favorites either.
Now, what did you love? What's your love on this?
My love, actually, it's probably the title track, Diamonds and Pearls, also. This is an album that my boss plays a lot in the office, which is maybe slightly inappropriate. So I actually know this album much better now than I did in the 90s. And yeah, so Diamonds and Pearls is probably my favorite. And then I would skip Strollin' just because I feel like I'm not moved by that song at all.
Right, right. Yeah. I'm with you. It's a mixed bag for sure, but it's worth, Diamonds and Pearls is worth every note, every single note, you know? So I'm just like, I love it so much, that song, that I kind of feel like all's forgiven.
yeah. And I gotta say, I'm not usually into ballads, but I feel like that is a perfect ballad.
I agree. And just that whole Diamonds and Pearls, yeah, you know, like way it goes is like, and it's even cheesy and I still love it. Like Diamonds and Pearls, okay, really? But I still love it.
Yeah, well, actually, I was reading that the song was named after two of his dancers. one he would call Diamond and the other one he would call Pearl. Oh my God. And they're actually on the album cover and they're in the music videos for Cream and Get Off.
Oh yeah, yeah. And they look just like Vanity and Apollonia and Sheila E. and every other woman that's in uh-huh. other thing.
Pretty much.
Yeah, amazing.
Yeah, well, do you want to talk about our next album?
Yes, sure. Do you want to bring it up or do I bring it up?
Well, I was pretty excited when you chose this one because I'm sure Matt, you too, were really into this album. Yes. Hedwig and the Angry Inch.
Yeah. And I want to be clear, it's the off-Broadway cast soundtrack that I am specifically talking about.
Okay.
Yeah, because there's a few versions out now, so or probably even more than that.
Yeah, and I saw Hedwig 13 times.
Wow.
I saw every Hedwig, starting with John Cameron Mitchell and Michael Cerveris and Ellie Sheedy. And,
oh, my gosh.
Yeah. And so it was, for me, just this transcendent musical about people who were queer and othered and, you know, living in the margins. And it was also a rock opera. And it was also, it had so many emotional twists and turns. And I wish I would have seen them workshopping it down at Jackie 60. Because that would have been really cool to see back in the day, Stephen Trask and John working this out. But it is a beautiful story of pain and love and being an outsider. And to me, it's just, I was having a really hard skip one on this. The song that I play over and over again is, it's a cross between Wicked Little Town and Origins of Love. Mm-hmm. And I would say Origins of Love won by a hair of repeat for me. How about you guys?
Jen?
Yeah, I mean, for me, I picked Origin of Love, but like, I was kind of oscillating between that and Wicked Little Town too. So like, I don't know. Like, it's just, I wish I had seen the Broadway version of this, but I just wasn't hip to it, at the time. And I got more into it when it became like a film. Mm-hmm. And then I was obsessed with it and I would just watch it over and over again, like on my laptop. And I just have these memories of seeing like the visuals for when that song comes on, and then just being really into like the love message in it. So that one is always going to be like a repeat for me, I think. But obviously, also, I can be pretty basic sometimes, and Wig in a Box also.
Well, that's a great track.
I mean, it's so fun. And live, like, it's so empowering. Like, I feel like Wicked Little Town and Wig in a Box, when they reprise them both, is like so emotional.
Yeah.
You know, and especially, yeah, and that is so great.
So many like sing-alongs to that song, and
yeah,
and I also like remember I seeing like Polyphonic Spree at like Summer Stage, and John Cameron Mitchell came out, and they all sang "Wig in a Box," and I just like lost my mind.
Oh my god!
So, so many memories on that, Matt.
So I mean, Hedwig has such a special place in my heart that it's tough to kind of summarize it in, you know, in a few sentences. I first was introduced to Hedwig when the film came out. I was in college and I was coming out and I was confused and all that kind of stuff. And I saw the film and I was just like a mess. And since that moment, I've just been beyond a Hedwig fan. I used to go to the midnight showings of the film at IFC. And then I only saw it once on Broadway when it was revived. I saw it opening night with Neil Patrick Harris, which was great, but I feel like they were still working out the kinks a little bit. It's also very tough for me to pick like a favorite and a least favorite since I love this entire collection of songs. But I think if I were forced to, I would probably also pick Origin of Love, and also Midnight Radio. I feel like that moment in the script is just such a high emotional, I don't know, just like talking about it gets me a little verklempt, to be honest with you. I was messaging Jen earlier, like this morning I was re-listening to Origin of Love, and I was just like, I was kind of bawling sitting at the kitchen table by myself. That song has just so much power to it, you know?
Yeah.
And then I would probably skip Freaks if I were forced to, but I mean, I don't dislike the track.
Yeah, I had a hard time picking a skip too, actually. And then the more I listened to all the songs, the more I liked them even more. So it was like really hard. And but yeah, if I was forced to, maybe Freaks.
Interesting. I picked Hedwig's Lament. Because I feel like the emotionality throughout the whole play and throughout all the music, that to me is just a overview of the entire inside of Hedwig.
Yeah.
That, I could skip that and go right into the second part of that, All Because of You. And so for me, that's the only reason that I would skip it, is because I feel like I get that in other spaces. But yeah, I know it's really like that one was really a hard one to not have a pick of passing. Cause I just start to finish. That was, I think that's the record that I listened to most for a long time. Mm. And, it's just beautiful start to finish. And I will say in blasphemous terms, that I feel my favorite Hedwig was Michael Cerveris.
Mm. Oh, wow.
Yeah. John was great. Great, great, great. But, and I don't know, I don't know what it is about Michael Cerveris, but I loved Michael Cerveris as Hedwig. Ally Sheedy was something to see.
Mm.
It was bizarre. I'm not sure I loved it.
Yeah.
Because it was so different. But it was interesting. And Miriam as Yitzhak is just incredible. Her voice is incredible.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So
the whole thing was just the best. Yeah.
Yeah, this whole piece is just a masterpiece in my view.
I am so with you 100%. And it was a really good way to go out of the decade.
Yeah.
You
know, I think it was, you know, 1998, was it, that it came out?
And, yeah, 98, 99, something like that. Yeah.
And, just so beautiful. And also in one of those things that, like, this has never been done really before, you know, and to have something that was such an interesting, fresh piece of theater that was performance and storytelling and a musical and a rock show and a glam rock show. It was just, there was just everything that I love rolled up into this thing.
I think also, like, I was reading, it was kind of like the first Broadway production that really kind of crossed over, like, rock, you know, with musical, where, like, it appealed to a much broader audience than, like, a normal musical would have.
I think that's right. And I think everybody was sort of shocked by it.
Yeah. I wish I had seen it in the 90s.
Yeah,
like,
me too.
It would have been so amazing. But yeah, I like Matt, only saw it in the, you know, more current kind of revival. But I did get to see it with John Cameron Mitchell somehow. Like, he had broken his leg or something.
I saw it when he had the broken leg too.
Yes, and he just made it work. He worked it in.
It was so funny.
And it was amazing.
It was amazing. And I think, you know, it was great. And again, it goes back to, like, me being able to see it in the 90s was just that being born in a sweet spot of things that are, it's incredible. And I'm really sad because I'm not sure that the Jane Street Theater ever recovered after Sandy. Because it was a beautiful small theater, and it was the perfect place for that show to start, and would be such a great place for so many shows to workshop. And I think it never recovered. I'm curious about that, but
I think it's fascinating to see how it was able to come back and make this kind of revival, but also, like, I saw that, like, a production of it went to, like, Korea, South Korea, which I found fascinating. Just, like, culturally. Wow. Like, never would I have thought something so, you know, gender bending kind of production would actually go to a country that I view is a little conservative. So I was just like, I feel like the times have really progressed where something like that could happen is kind of just, like, really interesting.
I agree. I didn't know that.
Yeah, me neither. That's wild.
It's totally wild.
So cool.
Hedwig, I mean, I feel like it'll live forever.
Yeah, you
know? I do too. And think about it. It's, let's see, 20 years old, right?
Wow.
And it's still incredible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it just holds up so well, I think.
So well.
Yeah.
I can't imagine, like, back then, was it, like, super controversial?
I think it was, in the sense of, you know, people didn't know about transgender people and used the, you know, slurs and said transsexual or transvestite, or, you know, there wasn't a lot of conversation, language, knowledge around the pain and existence and world of trans folks. So I think it was, I think that the messiness of the life of Hedwig was possibly considered, like, kooky and eccentric rather than to the outside world, rather than this is a painful experience for somebody who's going through something that is what a lot of people go through, you know,
yeah.
You're not born in the body that you identify with, you know? And so I think that there was, a sensational, draggy appeal. But I think that the underlying pieces of it for the people who like the three of us, who understand just humanity and live amongst people who are experiencing different levels of humanity and how they're treated in the world by who they are. I think that's why it so profoundly affects people like us, because it hits you in the gut in a way that even if you didn't care and just love the music, the next level of exploring that experience is interesting. And also the humor of it, you know, the fact that like the wall came down like right after the crazy fun watch thing, you know, all of that. And then ending up in Kansas and just having
the worst.
Matt, did it like strike you like, you know, in a particular way, like back then?
I think immediately it did. And to this day, it does. Actually, my sentiment and my reaction to the songs and the film and seeing the show, you know, on Broadway and that revival, it's all the same for me. It's all just like, I don't know, it kind of tears me apart, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, just like, but on like a more personal level, like, did it like have any kind of effect on you?
Oh, you mean like sort of as I was coming out and whatnot?
Yeah.
I think for me, yeah, I mean, I never really thought about it too much, but I think just seeing, I don't know, for some reason, I think part of the reason why probably a lot of people are so enamored with the character, with the role, with the show, is just because they see a sense of Hedwig in them, like Liz was saying, kind of that outsider status, but also kind of championing through and just being your true self. And I think I wasn't living my true self, and I think that's what I kind of connected with. Like, maybe I can do this, and I should move forward with and not hold back with who I am. And I think that's probably what I related to on a more personal level.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I want to go back and really take it in now, especially seeing who we are as a society and how we feel about immigrants and how we feel about people who have fled oppression and trying to make a life for themselves and who takes advantage of them and how they're demonized. You know, like it's, that story is, it has changed a lot, especially because I think Americans have gotten more callous and colder in a lot of ways when it comes to that. And so, you know, it's just kind of like, where are we at? Who are we?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I feel like that's a really good way to end this episode.
Yeah.
So fun. Thank you for inviting me.
Yes, thanks so
much. Your dream guest. Thank you.
Totally.
Oh, we have so much to talk about. Well, anytime, you know, maybe we should do it again after I go through my cassettes and I can figure out my two most, we can have a conversation about the two most amazing mixtapes that I found in my collection.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Welcome back anytime.
Welcome so much. Thank you for just making this joyful podcast to listen to so we can talk about things that are good and cool.
Thank you, Liz. Thanks so much for joining us on Mixtape Memories, and we'll catch you next time. Bye.
Bye.